having that extra support to kind of point me in the right direction was really important. And I think to anyone who's looking to start that entrepreneurial journey is like build out that network where you've got people that you can ask mm-hmm. questions to, because even if just for the confidence alone, just like knowing that you've got that mm-hmm. that person that you can kind of ask stupid questions to is like,
yeah,
is really helpful.
Hi, I am Sophie Vu, and this is the Rise and Play podcast. In the show, I sit down with influential thought leaders in the gaming industry to deconstruct how they create the best teams and company cultures in order to create the best games. Speaking to hundreds of game executives in the show, I have identified recurring patterns and mistakes that we all make in our leadership journey. Do you have to go through the same hurdles and make the same mistakes to learn too? You are not alone in this journey, and hopefully, you can learn from a diverse range of seasoned leaders who already walked the talk. Every episode brings actionable insights and case studies that will help you improve your management skills, self-awareness, and empathic communication. Becoming a better leader starts with becoming a better human. Are you ready to unlock your full potential in life and business? Let's begin. All right. Hi, everyone. Greetings from London, PGC London. And today I'm sitting with Laura Carter, the CEO of Trees Please Studio. But I'm so happy that we get to talk because I was contacting Laura for the context a few years ago. It's like, not the right time, not the right time. And well, here we are. I'm in London coming to you to have an interview.
I know. I couldn't say no anymore, Sophie. But yeah, thanks for being
I'm very persistent.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was early days, I think, when we first spoke. So it was one of those kind of head down moments in terms of like just trying to get the game built. But yeah, we launched Longleaf Valley last year. And so, yeah, I thought it was a good time to connect and have a chat and finally meet you in person.
Great finally. To be here with you. Very post-COVID and so on.
Yeah.
So maybe if you could give a quick intro as well about what was your background before you started the company? Where were you at the time? And what was the transition point where, okay, this is it. I'm going to build a company in 2020.
Yeah, not 2019. Yeah.
2019.
So I've been in games for about 17 years. My background was originally in the production side of things, and then like the last kind of 7 years was more like the product side, and then obviously like team and now company leadership. I've worked in studios like PlayStation and Disney and Square Enix, where I headed up the London mobile studio for production side of things, and then also like smaller studios like Us Two Games. And then my most recent role before Trees Please was at Natural Motion, where I was a product lead on CSR2 and then general manager of the third party development division. So I guess I've always had a massive passion for games, and I like loved games, but I've also had in parallel like a big, I don't know, I don't like to call it a passion because it's more of a purpose or a sort of a calling in terms of the environment, saving the environment and sort of animals and nature. It's always something that's just been very important to me, like even from a very young age, like 3-4 years old, I remember like telling my parents that I was going to be a veggie because I didn't want to eat animals, and then just always like being really into like Greenpeace and just really inspired by what those activists were doing. And so from a young age, I would literally go around knocking on doors with my big sister, like selling toys, selling drawings, like just doing whatever I could to like raise money. And obviously like it was so, so tiny and meaningless, but like in my own little way, I thought I was doing something. And then into my like teens and 20s, I did stuff like, you know, volunteering in charity shops and fundraising. And then I ended up getting into like activism and protesting and having more of a presence. And when even on my lunch hours, like I remember working at PlayStation, like going out protesting on my lunch hour and then coming back and like being a producer on the project. So it was like really exciting, but also like a lot. And I think when I got into my 30s, I was like, this is really hard to maintain like all of this at the same time, as well as also just the fact that I felt like this is probably not changing the world. Like whilst I'm putting a lot of energy into it, like it's really just scratching the surface in terms of what it will take to really, you know, reverse climate change with the kind of things that I'm doing. And so I thought, you know, hold on a minute, I'm here in this like incredible position where I'm making games. Like I was working on CSR2, a game that was, you know, had hundreds of millions of downloads and was making, you know, huge amounts of money. And I was thinking like, I want to be doing this, but with extra purpose involved. Like, I could reach a huge audience with games. I've got a great network. You know, I've built up a career in understanding how to make successful products. And so, you know, I really need to use that opportunity and combine my passion for games and my, you know, my purpose for sort of trying to make a difference in the world. So that was the kind of, I guess, the motivation and the idea. And so, yeah, I left Natural Motion to start Trees Please kind of late 2019 to do just that. And then, yeah, I guess we can go on in the next section about like how that, how the company started, et cetera. Yeah.
Like aligning the purpose, your personal purpose with your profession is, it's not one easy to combine. And I want to spend a bit of a moment of understanding that transition for you, because when I look at games, especially mobile games, right? We have been also on mobile games. It's not the most purpose-driven type of project. It's very market-focused, consumer-driven, and also looking a lot into profit and revenues. Yeah. It's also, it was, it's your first company, right? That you, so what became so, I would say, big for you that you say, okay, I will take the leap of faith to build a company with purpose in something I truly believe, although there was not so many signals or examples in the industry even today around more purpose-driven companies. And also the other aspect is also building your first company where there are not so many women representing. So I'm just curious, like, what gave you just the courage of a conviction? Is that I'm going to leave my job, I'm going to do this, and we'll see.
Probably naivety, to be honest with you, like not realizing at that point quite how the odds are stacked against you. But I think it really was that purpose and passion. Like, I just felt that, and I still do, I just feel this kind of raging need to like, and even now I'm just like, I want to do more. I want to like, you know, we're coming up to this huge milestone of planting nearly a million trees, and that's incredible. But I'm like, I want to plant 100 million. And it's just really wanting like this mission and this purpose, as I say, is just is so big for me. And I think for me, that need just became like a desperate need, where it's like, I think it's hard to maintain motivation in something else, even like an amazing game that I was working on, like CSR2, which I was really proud of. I think once you've got that idea, it's really hard to stay motivated in something else. And I also had a baby, like, that year, I think it was. And there was that extra drive and motivation where I was like, you know, I'm worried about my kids' future, you know, the science about climate change and what's going to happen in the next like 20, 30 years. Like, I need to do this for him as well. And now I have a second child, so for both of my kids. And so I think another thing that made it feel more possible was I was in a really fortunate position that I had a great like friend and mentor. So Sean Rutland, who's like the CEO of Hutch Games, he said, like, you know, I'll point you in the right direction. I'll kind of, because I think I had a lot of experience in terms of building products and leading teams and like the game side, but starting a company and getting investment, I was like, I don't understand this world at all. So kind of having that extra support to kind of point me in the right direction was really important. And I think to anyone who's looking to start that entrepreneurial journey, is like build out that network where you've got people that you can ask questions to, because even if just for the confidence alone, just like knowing that you've got that that person that you can kind of ask stupid questions to is like is really helpful.
Something I can relate to, which is always the balance, like building a company, being a mother, and here you just did everything at once, like birth of a company and actual, you know, birth of a kid. Maybe I just wanted to ask if, I don't know if it was naive at the time, but it didn't seem to block you. So like, okay, I'm a mother, but I also build a company. And did you remember what was going through your mind at that time?
Well, do you know, actually, so my wife actually gave birth to our son. So I think it made it a little bit easier that like, I wasn't like literally going through like, you know, all the hormonal journey and the sort of the physical impact of having a child at that point, though I did have my second child. So I kind of experienced all of that like in the last year or two. But I think, you know, it's still an incredibly demanding place to be as a new parent, like trying to juggle, you know, just the intense like energy it takes to be a mum with a child that wakes up all through the night and, you know, run a business where you're not just doing 8-hour days. Like, also COVID struck as well on top of it all within, it was like, so I left Natural Motion in September 19 and then I got COVID in February 2020 and then the whole like lockdown, everything started in like March. And so that was really scary because less about like my health and just more like, ah, like the world is going upside down. Like, what's going to happen? Like, am I going to be able to like hire a team? Am I going to like, how is this going to affect like the world of work and everything? And actually, like, it ended up being, I think, a positive thing for at least starting a company. Like, obviously, there's other aspects to COVID which were really, really horrific. But purely from like a hiring perspective, I think it wasn't a disaster, because I think so many people were really questioning their life choices and their long-term ambitions and having those reflective moments about what they wanted to do with their life. And joining a company that was doing something really purposeful and exciting and making a difference in the world and you know, directing your career in a way that you can do something that you're really proud of, I think really helped me to bring in a great founding team. So, but yeah, you're right. Like, there was a huge amount going on with like kids and startup and COVID and hiring and all of that. And it was all a crazy, crazy time. And I look back and it was just a complete fog. But, you know, here we are 4 years later on and, you know, still going. So, yeah.
Yeah. Going forward, when you decided to start, like from my numerous conversation as well, hardest question when you start is, who do you start with? And how do you start when you go from security, financial security, to, okay, starting something new? How do I finance that? So I have a question around, how did you form your team of co-founders, if you have co-founders? And how did you start to fund yourself? What was the journey for you, especially during COVID as well? And, you know, like timing around 2020, different context.
Yeah. So I started on my own. I think it was one of those things where like you talk to people about starting a company when you work in a bigger studio and everyone's like, yeah, like, you know, we'll do this and we'll do that. And actually when push comes to shove and you're like, okay, let's do it. Like actually there's that massive step and that leap of faith and, you know, not earning money, like the uncertainty of funding. I think that, you know, not everybody has that level of risk appetite. And so, like I said, there was this desperation. I couldn't wait for like 6 months or 12 months to for everybody, whoever, would, you know, so I just was like, right, I'm going to do it. And I spent that first kind of year, like to 18 months, really, like building that sort of founding team. So I guess like not kind of traditional co-founders that were there from the very start, but like, you know, bringing them in within that sort of first sort of, like year-ish. To kind of build the right people that ultimately would have the right, you know, ambition and like be really engaged in the mission, because I think that's so important that everybody's aligned around that, especially, you know, the very early people in the business. I think that was a really important part for me, was finding people that were excited by the mission. And then the fact that we wanted to kind of really focus in the casual puzzle space and the merge space meant that there was obviously criteria there around, you know, the experience and the studios they worked in and the products that they worked on and that side of things. So it was kind of like headhunting mode that I was in, to be honest, and just really kind of going through my network and my network's network and kind of just spending a long time making sure that I found the right people. And then, yeah, as I say, kind of a year-ish, I brought in an engineering focus and a design focused co-founder. And then we really started, you know, building Longleaf Valley.
Awesome. And I think here it's also a good experience to share, where in the investors world, especially in a context where trying to reduce the maximum of risks, like let's invest in teams that have worked together, co-founders. And in this case, it was didn't start maybe that way. What were the learnings for you of what it looks like to hire co-founders? Because this is also a path, right? When you start first alone with a vision, the ambition of what you want to build, and then you're hiring the team that will also go with you. So if there are some learnings or some advice you can give as well, if someone would want to hire co-founders, maybe the things to pay attention to.
I think that like certainly working together previously like helps, because you just already know everything and it's like you see it with your own eyes, as opposed to when you're talking to people, obviously it's kind of harder to always like read between the lines. But I think, you know, it's not just like an interview where you're just like looking at skills. Like I think like with any great placement, especially at like a senior level, you need to think about, how do you gel with this person? You know, how do you connect as people? Have you got aligned values? Do you have the same aspirations for the studio? And I think it's kind of a long process. That's why, as I say, it took like best part of 18 months. partly just to, you know, to make sure that, you know, kind of go through that, like that shopping list and on both sides of, yes. of what needs to be right to make this happen, because it is a big step. You know, you're generally kind of coming in not necessarily on the same level of salary as when you've worked in previous companies, mm-hmm. you know, so there's often a bit of a sacrifice there, like particularly for my sake, like, as I say, you asked about funding, like the first like 18 months was like, you know, living off savings, right? Yeah. So it's a big commitment for anybody that's, you know, starting out a studio. And so you've got to try and de-risk as much as possible around like, who are you doing it with?
Mm. So then the first year, if I get it correctly, was really focusing on building the foundation for yourself, the team, which is really the starting point. And only after, this is when you started to maybe look for funds, like not relying only on your savings and starting to build the game. So what were the steps, the journey then of fundraising and building the product and further the team building the product?
So I actually started the conversations with investors like fairly early, but not to like get funding yet, but just more to understand their interest and appetite for the direction we were going, for the mission of the business, and just, get their guidance and advice and kind of have them like invested in our growth from the outset. But, you know, one of the things I learned very quickly was like, you know, build the team and then we can actually have more serious conversations. So I was like, okay. So like, that sounds so obvious now in hindsight, but that's why, like I say, naivety earlier on, because I think I just didn't fully understand that like, I can get investment and then I can build the team. It's like, no. So yeah, I guess in parallel, it was building the team and just building out that sort of strategy, like what kind of games we want to build, where's the market opportunity, how is this going to work with the mission and an environmental theming of a game, and just building out a lot of those high level pillars and strategy, whilst also, as I say, building the team. And then once I had the key kind of founding team in place, that was when, as I say, I could have more meaningful like investor conversations. And then we closed our first pre-seed round. It was around 18 months after I started, which was a huge moment. And, you know, it just really felt like, okay, this is actually happening now. And I'm not just me in my spare bedroom, but actually like we're now an official studio. We've got money.
Yeah. And if we could get into the detail, if of course you're willing to share, pre-seed at the time, who invested in you? Was this more like from VCs or more angel network? Yeah. And maybe also the route further, like seed round. So like the funding journey for you.
Yeah. So it was VC predominantly. I also had a selection of angels as well, which was more about like having really smart, intelligent people that would be really invested in the business. So I had a selection of angels, and Lakestar was our initial pre-seed investor. So we raised like a £1 million pre-seed round. And then we raised a further kind of seed round like a year or two afterwards, basically. And then we kind of in between those two, we were building out the team and ultimately getting kind of more metrics and more validation. The first round was really like team idea and, you know, high level. I think we did have a demo, like a first playable, but it was quite light touch. And I think we had some very, very early metrics, like really strong kind of day one to sort of day three retention figures. By the second round, it was, you know, monetization, like more like midterm retention, much more validation ultimately.
Great. Out of curiosity, because the mission and the environmental part was so strong in your purpose, in the core of the company, how was the reception as you go around VCs and you know it's not like when you go with an environmental mission, you can't make it very tangible, at least that's my perception, with numbers and like it will return you billions. You know, this is not on the commercial route where you will exist with a unicorn. So I was curious about how this conversation went, where I'm sure you didn't compromise on your mission. But then what was the process for you to select also the partners and what was the, without getting details of specific VCs, but really where you also learn like maybe it's a hard sell, maybe for some that are really focused on the business, the numbers, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think on the whole, investors were actually really interested in the mission side. And like you say, I definitely didn't compromise it. In fact, I really doubled down on it because it is the central mission of the studio. And so I don't want to, you know, only focus on the product and numbers and then have to feel like we're somehow like shoehorning this stuff in that we actually care about. And I think, you know, for me, there was a thesis that, you know, we really want to change the world. We really want to make a significant impact. And there's an opportunity to do something really important whilst also creating a, you know, a fast growing, exciting business. And the two can go hand in hand. And the thesis is about, you know, the fact that, you know, we can hire really talented people that, that like me, get to a point in their career where, you know, they've, you know, worked on a great product, they're in a management position, and you feel about like, what next? Do I want to like keep climbing the ladder, or do I care about doing something that both combines passion and purpose? And I think more and more people that I speak to do like really relate to that. And then, so the hiring was a big piece. And then I felt like, you know, I don't feel like this has to compromise the product. Like, I think it can compromise the product if it's not done right. And so it's really important you have a really talented team. So that's why I set about to build a team that had worked on, you know, great top grossing casual puzzle games that knew how to build good product, but also cared about the mission as well.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that's always been a fine balance for us, is like, how do we build a really sticky, exciting, you know, successful product, but also, you know, include the environmental themes and the messaging that interests the players, but also doesn't create friction where it starts to get in the way of the entertainment as well, or start to feel too much where it's like, this isn't fun anymore. This feels too like, you know, too educational, for example. Yeah. So I think that balance has always been something that, you know, we've thought about a lot. But I think, you know, the value from the investment perspective is, you know, this is a differentiation. There is an opportunity for us to really engage and, you know, increase like player loyalty or player sentiment through this kind of stuff. Like, there's also a cost, right? Because we're planting trees, and that's obviously doesn't come for free.
Yeah.
So I think ultimately there's a balance, but as I say, with a really strong team, like, I think those are challenges that you can overcome and like stand out, right? In a really, you know, competitive landscape. So I think ultimately when we met the right investors that were really excited about what we were doing as well, and I could just feel that energy and that like excitement about the mission as well, you kind of just know that it's right. So yeah, we've been really lucky with both of our investors, Lakestar and March Gaming, who have both just been like so supportive and really excited about what we're doing.
That's great to hear. And I think this is also to give a more broader picture of an investment where it's not just there's space for companies that also are driven by purpose, while being also competitive commercially.
Yeah.
And what's interesting with the product that you've been building with Longleaf Valley is like figuring out how can you serve a purpose through still product and entertainment and that balance. And I guess this is the novelty part to figure out, and that's what your team was set to do. And getting now more in the product part, I wanted to ask more if you could tell us more about Longleaf Valley, how it started, and maybe because it's been a journey of 4 years now, what were the learnings of iteration even, that where you maybe, like you said, approach it at some different angles, maybe too much education or even like core mechanics, gameplay, how you started and where you are today, like at least with the product pillars or strategy?
So in terms of the strategy, I guess I'll start with the kind of four good strategy in a way, which is slightly separate from the product strategy, but we want to do good through three key things. One is through creating awareness around climate change and environmental and animal related issues. I think that's really like the huge opportunity in terms of how you make real change, is if you get the mass market and, you know, everyday people really caring about this stuff and a cause, that's when, you know, consumer habits change and ultimately corporations change and government policy changes and that sort of stuff. So for me, that awareness piece and that educational piece, I guess, is really, really important. But like I said, that balance in terms of how far you push that so it doesn't interfere with the player experience is really, really important. The second part is doing good through more tangible instant impact. So the tree planting and sort of charitable donations. And that's something that we can very clearly like understand. We can say like, wow, we're just coming up to this incredible 1 million tree planting milestone. So it's like, that's something that we as a company can be really excited about, something our players can be excited about. And it feels very real and impactful. But ultimately, on its own, it's not enough, because you can keep planting trees, but if the problem and the cause is still there, where they're just getting cut down, then you're just like, it's like you've got a bucket with a hole in it, right? So So that awareness piece is really important, because that's where the change and the reduction and the demand changes. And then planting trees as well, it feels like it's a really good ultimate sort of strategy and solution. And then the third sort of pillar of our four good strategy is around being good for the player. And in that, I mean that, like, most people that you speak to actually, like, care about climate change. They care about wanting to make a difference. But most people are just, you know, so busy with their day-to-day lives, or they just don't really know what they can do aside from, like, recycling at home and this and that. It's like, how do I actually make a difference? And so, you know, I think there's a huge opportunity for, like, all companies to reflect on, like, how do we, you know, act more sustainably? How do we make it easier for our customers and our players, or whoever is your, you know, your clients, to actually be impactful? And so I was quite inspired by things like Amazon Smile or on eBay, where you can, like, donate at the checkout. It's like making it really friction-free and kind of easy for people to make a difference. And you don't really feel the cost of it too much, because it's these, like, micro impacts that you do over, like, a long period of time. And I feel like this model couldn't really work as well in the premium space, because it's got a much smaller audience. So reaching, like, a vast, vast audience of players, and then, like, almost like mobilizing that community to do good and to plant trees and to create awareness, I think is a really exciting opportunity. And for people to come away from playing our games feeling like no guilt, because even me as a game maker, you know, there's that thing of like, oh, I really need to, like, get this work done or do this thing for the kids. Like, you have this, like, guilt about playtime and spending money in games. And so, like, people coming away from a Trees Please game feeling, like, really proud, like, actually, this is purposeful. I'm planting trees, I'm doing something good, feels like, you know, it's good for people and planet as well. Going back to your original question, which was about the journey to the, I'm trying to remember now, because I've been talking about the other
thing.
Yeah,
but it's good we started with a foundation. Maybe the key pivotal moments in terms of product and the learnings you had, like trying to exactly deliver that experience that at the same time serves your mission, also player experience, player's purpose as well, like for the ones who really care about climate and the execution of it, right? I'm sure you've learned quite a lot as well from that journey.
Yeah, I think we trod a bit more carefully at the beginning, because we were worried about the friction piece. So actually, like, as you play through Longleaf Valley, the environmental, like, messaging gets stronger as you get further into the game. And conscious of, like, not wanting to make a game that would only appeal to climate activists, you know, it's quite a small market. So wanting it to be really, really broad, to have the biggest possible reach. And also, obviously, from a business impact, right? Like, we need to be able to target the full market. Later, you know, content and areas within the game now, we kind of do, like, really lean into some of the key topics around around climate change, including, like, fossil fuels and animal agriculture and deforestation and those kind of topics. Whereas in the earlier phase, we do still talk about, like, pollution and the impact on Longleaf Valley and the park that Ash and Jim, the two lead characters in the game, are working to restore. But actually, we kind of felt like those themes were actually so well received, and the drama, like, we wanted to kind of just amp it up a little bit. And we didn't see any issues in terms of drop off or churn or retention. So we felt like, okay, we've kind of found a sweet spot there. I think in terms of, like, other learnings, it kind of just really depends on the stage you're at. I think for us, it was always about, like, validation. It's like, what is the key thing that we need to validate at this stage of the project? And so earlier on, it's, you know, retention and engagement. And then it's like, we're validating around monetization. Actually, in hindsight, like, now, I think that, you know, validating things like marketing and scalability and things like ROAS, like, bringing that as early as possible feels like that's more important in the kind of post-IDFA world, where obviously marketing and scaling is a bit more challenging these days. So that's a bit of a reflection. But I think, like, innovating as well is something that's been, you know, really important. Obviously, we have our innovation around the tree planting and the charitable integration and the theme as well. But I don't think on that alone it's necessarily enough. You've also got to think about, you know, gameplay and what are the things that are going to engage players and stand out and be different as well. And, you know, the quality bar is so high in the market. And, you know, you've got, you know, bigger studios, you've got bigger teams and more money that are in the same space. So, you know, it's really competitive and challenging. But as I say, I think that's why, like, having a really strong team has been like so critical for us being successful to this point.
Mm. How many are you today?
We're just 15, actually. Okay. Yeah, so we're quite lean.
Yeah, that's good. I'm curious about audience now as well. You mentioned as well that good reception. Where is your audience? Like, what were the findings as opening your game? Because I guess it's not just the West, I believe, that is interested or cares about the topic. But what were the discovery about having a game that is really explicit in being, mission-driven around environment and maybe some learnings and winning moments for you as well with the audience and reception of the game?
Yeah, I think so. Actually, the audience does align very closely with more like typical casual puzzle games, necessarily more than like the environmental angle. Like, it's predominantly female, like, it's, you know, it's fairly broad, but like it skews towards female, it's skews towards like 25, 30 plus. Mm-hmm. You know, our key market is the US and the UK. So it is like fairly consistent, really, with other, you know, merge or match three kind of audience.
Okay. Now after product, team and culture. So maybe specifically to Trees Please, how have you formed the team and the culture? How are you working like hybrid, remote? Where's the team base? And maybe in your ways of working, if there are things you can share, but where that environmental mission is translated very specifically to your culture, or there are some parts of it?
Yeah. So as I said, 15 people, we have a hybrid way of working. Like, even before COVID, to be honest, I was planning on doing a sort of a 2 days working from home, like 3 days in the office thing, because I thought that, you know, with flexibility and how that was super valuable for people even back then. But then obviously COVID happened and everyone went fully remote for a while. And then going back into the office, it's kind of the other way around now. So we have like 3 days a week at home and 2 days in the office. I think that's really important for us, like, to be able, especially with a small team and a startup where you're building culture and you're building, you know, trust and connection between the team. And I think initially that was actually quite challenging, like getting people back in the office, because you've had like a year or two working from home and, you know, there's a caution and there was a fear, obviously, like from a health concern perspective, obviously, very rightly. But also, you know, the ease and the comfort and the flexibility that comes from working from home. But I think once everybody actually started to come into the office, it was actually so exciting. Like, I actually met people that I'd worked with for like a year that I'd never seen in person, which was so crazy. But it was just like a buzz to kind of actually hang out together and to have those sidebar conversations that you don't have as easily when you're kind of on a Zoom call or a Hangouts call. And so we carried on that. And so the whole studio all comes in on the same 2 days a week so that we have that. I think when you're a big company, you can be a bit more flexible on the days. But when you're a small team, if it's a free for all, you might end up there's only like two of you in the office on any one day, which isn't that useful. No. So we kind of have two set days a week and everybody comes in on those days. And that's been working for us really, really well.
Okay. You did mention of some parts that were challenges and learning. But really, when you look at the block of the past 4 years, and it's a lot, it's a long time period. But really, you as the CEO and having formed the team, the co-founders team, the product launching in 2023, scaling, which has its own context. Key learnings maybe for you, what like you're really proud of that went really well, and the things that you didn't see coming and that actually are really challenges and maybe your point of focus in the future.
Yeah. I think things going well, I mean, first and foremost is the strength of our team. I think we've got such an incredibly talented team and, you know, I'm just so grateful that they're part of Trees Please. And as I mentioned, I think like the strength of the vision and the mission has really been in part, you know, part of bringing in great people, but then also great people attract great people as well. Yeah. So it's sort of really a snowball effect. So having that initial founding team being really strong, I think is really critical to success, both on a product and a kind of culture and a hiring side. Other great things, I think the product, like I think Longleaf Valley is like a lovely game. It's got heart, it's got drama, it's, you know, doing something good and it's making revenue. We've got good numbers. So I think like we're in a really fortunate position where things have gone like pretty smoothly and obviously like a tough market. Obviously planting trees, like something that like I'm just so proud of. It's just such a pinch me moment. Like I just think back to you know, my original like vision for the company and just thinking, you know, I know it sounds a bit crazy and hard, but just going to go for it. And here, like these years later, yeah. with a game that's in the market, with a team and like about to reach this 1 million tree planting milestone, which just feels like, you know, yeah, like a massively proud moment for myself and the team, like who all work so, so hard on this mission. And so, yeah, that's gone really, really well. Yeah, I think like platform holder support's been really strong. I think just in general, like the thesis around, you know, hiring, player sentiment as well. Like mm-hmm. we look at our reviews, we just get so many comments about like, I love this game and I can plant real trees while playing. It's like, you mm-hmm. know, it just feels like players really yeah. love what they're able to do through playing games. So yeah, it feels really good that, again, those kind of three key pillars mm-hmm. of that strategy are all kind of hitting as hoped. In terms of challenges or opportunities, I think ultimately like growing is the big opportunity. Like you mentioned, we're a single game studio right now. We're thinking about what comes next and becoming a multi-game studio. And ultimately, you know, we want to build out a portfolio of, you know, environmentally mm-hmm. focused or environmentally impacting casual puzzle games. You know, it's a tough market, but the casual puzzle space is continuing to grow despite like the overall games market being flat in 23. Yeah. So, you know, I think that there's still a lot of opportunity there for really high quality teams that are doing something different and innovating. I think challenges like are just around the balance of all the things that we're trying to do, like we touched on earlier on. Like building a successful game in this market is really, really tough. Mm. You know, even for the best studios yeah. in the world, like they obviously kill like more games than they release because it's really hard to replicate yeah. that success. So when you're doing it with a limited team and a limited budget, obviously it's really, really challenging. And then on top of that, we have constraints around, you know, the theming of the game and, you know, the fact that we have like donations and like the charitable piece as well. Like there's quite a lot there to balance. Mm. But I think again, like if you've got the right model and you're thinking about how do you do that all in a sustainable way that actually enhances the product and makes it stand out to players, like that's where the opportunity is. But it requires more effort, more thinking, yeah. more product and more design, like knowledge and focus to get that right. In terms of other challenges, I think just like external factors can be really tricky. You know, things like Unity, like changing pricing, which hasn't like hit us yet, but obviously in the future that will. We recently had like an analytics provider suddenly like shut shop, which means that we're like scrambling to, you know, change all of that, which takes your small team mm-hmm. off, you know, roadmap features, for example. And so that's always challenging to kind of juggle those kind of external mm-hmm. unknowns. And then things like, you know, tree planting costs, which have gone up in recent months as well, with kind of not a huge amount of warning. So these kind of things, which aren't always easy to predict, but that you have to kind of work with and work around. But yeah, in terms of like future outlook, like, as I say, we want to just keep growing and scaling Longleaf Valley. And building more games basically in the casual puzzle space. So that's the plan for the next year, for 24.
I will follow that closely, and like the effort I can recognize also, like kudos to you and the team, is really going the extra mile to making sure operationally that you can deliver, right? I'm sure it's not like a part that commercially that translates immediately when you have to do all the because I've been going through all the experience, like planting the trees, going through the form and learning more about the organization you work with. And it's extra work, right? That doesn't give a return immediately, but you have actually committed to the mission and you're delivering still on the player side, but on the mission side. So I think it's a great example of how it can be done. And I'm saying here for the listeners who would want to take that path, like at least having a leading studio that is doing it, has done it, has launched a game. I hope that others can connect with you to also ask like how you've set it up and how you've done, you know, your homework and so on to know how to execute this operationally.
Yeah, for sure. Like I'm definitely, my door is open if anyone wants to get in touch and talk about Games for Good and their ideas and any help I can offer, like would be happy to.
Mm-hmm. I think it will become a bigger and bigger social mission for not only in games, you know, organization, as we just can't ignore it, as well as, you know, the world is changing and there's imbalance around like planet preservation and like for at the cost of many of the things that at least we can rebalance a bit with games.
Thanks so much for chatting to me and hearing the story, and 1 million trees coming up in a couple of weeks' time. So
great, Marcy. Thanks, Laura, for today. And thanks, everyone, for tuning in. So you can connect with Laura later, and see you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this latest episode of the Rise and Play podcast. I am growing a community of conscious leaders across the industry and beyond. If you want to join this movement, please share the podcast with other conscious leaders, because we have so much more we can learn from each other. If you've enjoyed this episode, please follow and rate the show on Spotify or your other favorite podcast platform. It will help other growing leaders to discover the show and benefit from the valuable insights. If you would like to grow rapidly your leadership skills, you can find more insights on riseandplay.io, where you will also find my free masterclass on conscious leadership and other resources that I offer. Have a great week, and remember to take care of yourself. Until the next time,